Now, let's see the next slide, please. Thank you for your patience in waiting for this change. This one by Edgar Allan Poe, An Enigma. Now, this is a little more complicated than the usual one. Instead of being the initial letter all the time, this is what's called a cross acrostic, or a sequential acrostic, or progressive acrostic. The first letter in the first line, the second line, the third line, and so on. It spells out Sarah Anna Lewis. Now then, here's another one. This spells out the same way, Francis Osgood. The second one of these two ladies, namely Mrs. Osgood, apparently had a boyfriend, not Poe, a chap named Rufus W. Griswold. She wrote one. You see, there she entwined her name, Frances Osgood, with Rufus Griswold, see? Now, Frances made two small errors, but let's be charitable and give her at least an A for effort, because she hid two names in her piece, whereas Poe hid but one. To do what Mrs. Osgood did isn't easy. You might try your hand at this sort of thing when you've got time to spare. A chap who flourished more than four centuries ago, one Sir John Salisbury, a solid sort of citizen, married and all that, apparently had a yen for a lady, not his wife. He wrote poetry, not addressed openly to said lady, but hid her name in his poems dozens of times in several different ways. This he did by embodying acrostics so skillfully devised that their presence in his poetry wasn't discovered until comparatively recently. I'll show you three specimens, not in the original handwritten form, but in a modern printed transcript, so that you can see easily the acrostics. This is a simple one. Dorothy Halsall was the lady's name. There he has her name entwined. You see the Dorothy, this is at the caesural pause, and Cuthbert this way, and there, that's her husband's name, by the way. And this is J. S. John Salisbury. And here's one, I can only show you a part of it. There are five names entwined in this poem. The differentiation is made by printing. In other words, this is a part of Dorothy. You see that capital in the first line? That's the second stanza, Dorothy, and so on. And then the next name is the second, you take the second line, initial letters, the third name, you take the third, and so on. See, now this is a little tricky. In the one I showed you where John Salisbury got Dorothy's name and Cuthbert's name in, I just am sorry, but I couldn't find John's wife's name. That's too bad. Maybe your name didn't lend itself to the purpose. Anyhow, well, if you're going to prove anything by means of acrostics, why not prove that Shakespeare wrote Shakespeare by telestics? That's taking the last letters of lines. There you are. All the titles of the plays arranged. There we have, smart. Shakespeare wrote the great tales. Do you want to go the antepenultimate letter? There you are, William Shakespeare. Now, undoubtedly, the longest acrostic thus far found in literature is that constructed in a marathon effort in 1521 by Boccaccio, whose Amoroso Visione, a poem of 50 cantos, is dedicated to a young married lady named Maria d'Aquino. The initial letters of the initial lines of the successive sets of three lines in the 50 cantos make an acrostic of 1,501 letters, which itself is in the form of two sonetti and a madrigal. The first of the two sonetti carries within it, mind you, a secondary acrostic. For the initial letters of its first, third, fifth, seventh, and ninth lines spell Maria. Boccaccio was certainly enamored of that gal. This, by the way, is I have among my exhibits the book in which that long acrostic appears. And if you would like, at the end of the talk, come and examine it, but I ask you please be careful. It's a precious little thing. Yes. Professor Hedlund reminded me this morning of something in the way of acrostics, which leads me to say that every university should have a special assistant to the president thereof, who is to be an expert anagrammatist, because in one of our leading universities a few years ago, the baccalaureate hymn, which was sung with great fervor by members of the audience, including delightful mothers and grandmothers and aunts and so forth, was demonstrated several days after the ceremony to contain an acrostic which is quite unprintable. Now, one very important feature of acrostics, and I mean authentic acrostics, no matter which of the many varieties is used, is that they follow definite rules in their construction. In every real acrostic, the rules for selecting the letters of the hidden text are invariable, and the selection follows a fixed pattern. Moreover, the selected letters are chosen in a particular order, and acrostics so skillfully, and the rules for setting them out in the form of a text are rigid and inflexible. This is clearly seen in Poe's progressive acrostics that I showed you. This one shows it too. It is never a matter of taking, say, the first letter of the first line, the seventh of the tenth of the second line, the fourth of the third line, and so on. Nor is it a matter of rearranging these letters until we find a nanogram of them which makes sense. This must be true of any acrostic whose existence is not to be open to doubt. That is, whether its presence is intentional or accidental. The second point in favor of acrostics is that they have unquestionably been used to establish claims of authorship. And when an indubitable acrostic appears, only the author could have inserted it, because it is part and parcel of what he has written. A striking example is found in an anonymous Latin work published in 1616. The consecutive initial letters of the 53 sections into which the book is divided spell without a single deviation the sentence Franciscus Godwinus Landavensis Episcopus Hos Conscripsit. That is, Francis Godwin, the Bishop of Llandaff, wrote these lines. And here is another actual example of such a case. First, the title of the book. You will note that the author was ostensibly a Count of Torrene, Don Pedro Battista Pino, But his ghostwriter was not to be denied all credit for his work. The first letters of successive sentences, beginning on page 43, with paragraphs or breaks between the words, reveal the name. I marked some of them. Hard to see. Juan Lopez Cancelada, a surreptitious but nonetheless certain manifestation of the ghostly hand which held the pen. We must now devote a few words to anagrams, for they too play an important role in our story. Anagrams have been known and used for centuries. In at least two cases, they were used to establish priority in scientific discovery. Huygens, for example, wrote out a sentence stating his findings in regard to Saturn's rings, and then he wrote on another slip of paper a list in alphabetical order of the 62 letters used in the sentence stating his discovery. 7 A's, 5 C's, 1 D, 5 E's, and so on. This slip of paper he dated and sent to a friend to keep for him until he completed his confirmatory investigations. Galileo had already gone one step further than Huygens. He rearranged the letters of his original statement of his discovery to make other Latin words, and these he sent to Kepler. When the letters are rearranged in their correct order, they state in Latin that the mother of love imitates the phases of Cynthia, the moon. The mother of love of Venus imitates the phases of Cynthia, the moon. Now, a true anagram partakes of the nature of the type Galileo used, for in order to be, as some writers say, perfect, an anagram should not only involve a rearrangement of the letters without additions or deletions. The resulting word or words should in some way comment upon the original. For example, radical reform, anagrammed into rare mad frolic. Presbyterian, best in prayer. Washington crossing the Delaware, he saw the ragged continentals row. Anagramming has always been popular. In the 16th century and 17th centuries, all the best people did it. Nowadays, newspapers run anagrammatic competitions and people play parlor games such as Scrabble. The longest English words so far discovered to be anagrams of each other are interrogatives and tergiversation. The longest anagram on record is in Spanish and consists of the name and titles of the Marquis de Astorga, anagrammatized into 8 lines of about 140 letters in a book entitled Francisco de la Torre y Cedil, and so forth. We should like here also to mention palindromes, a special type of anagram in which the reading is the same in either direction. For example, Madam, Hannah, and don't forget Adam's palindromic salutation upon meeting Eve. Madam, I'm Adam. It is alleged that he got a palindromic reply. Pointing to herself, she merely said, Eve. Those who would like to read about more anagrams should refer to Wheatley's Of Anagrams, London, 1862, several other books. Now let's dispose of anagrams in our Bacon Shakespeare garden. In Love's Labour's Lost, there occurs, among other words to which Baconians have devoted years of study, a long word spoken by the clown who remarks, I marvel thy master hath not eaten thee for a word, for thou art not so long by the head as honorificabilitudinitatibus. Thou art easier swallowed than the flap dragon. Now the same word, strange to say, is also found in the collected papers of Francis Bacon in the British Museum in the form of a triangle, H-O, H-O-N-O, H-O-N-O-R-I, winding up with the full word itself at the bottom of the heap. To make the matter even more mysterious, a shortened form of the word, honorificabilitudini, is found among other curious words on the flyleaf of a manuscript discovered in 1867 in Alnwick Castle in Northumberland, now and is now famous as the Northumberland Manuscript. The other curious words on the flyleaf of that manuscript, and you can come up and look at it later, are the names Francis Bacon, William Shakespeare, repeated 8 or 9 times, and words from the Shakespeare folio, the names of plays, Richard II, Richard III, and some lines refer to certain of Bacon's own writings, the names of certain essays. The manuscript is supposed to have been written in 1597. It's worth looking at. I'm waiting anxiously for a communication from the president of the Francis Bacon Society of Great Britain to send me what he threatens to be a proof that there is cipher in that manuscript. It's going to make me eat my words. Now, this long 27-letter word, honorificabilitudinitatibus, has really been and is still being given the works by the Baconians. The anagrams produced from it are somewhat weird. Usually they're in Latin, but I'm not sure the Latinity is acceptable to scholars. And when the Latin anagrams are translated into English, they still don't make much sense. For example, these plays produced by Francis Bacon are guarded for themselves. What does that mean? Of course, one is a bit handicapped in anagramming honorificabilitudinitatibus into good English words because it has for vowel content only 2 A's, 2 O's, and 7 I's, and not a single E. The best I could do after 20 minutes or so was, I writ this Iliad, not F. Bacon. If I had the patience or the cleverness of the author of this book, I'd be able to compose several good anagrams of our long word, despite its lack of ease. I wish I had time to tell you about finding this treasure. It took 12 years. Found it in Los Angeles, where it wasn't supposed to be at all. Now, the writer of this book, one Ernest Vincent Wright, who I think was an Angeleno, wrote a romantic novel of over 50,000 words in English. Not a single word contains the letter E, the most frequently used letter in English. He tells why he did it. This is a tour de force, sure. He tied down the E bar of his typewriter so he couldn't make a mistake. And I assure you that if I hadn't told you and you picked up the book and read the first 2 pages, you wouldn't suspect there's anything wrong with it. Very cleverly done. Now, I know of another author who had an aversion to the letter R. He never wrote a word containing that letter, and for the last few years of his life, he never spoke a word which had the letter R in it. Then there's the case of the 5-volume novel in Spanish. The first volume doesn't have a word containing the letter A. The second, not a word containing the letter E, and so on. James Thurber's recent book, last published, The Wonderful O. This is an example of what we call a logograms, lipograms, I'm sorry, lipograms, lipo meaning to drop gram, a word or letter. You drop letters or drop words. Well, James Thurber did it the easy way. You see, all he did was to take words that had the O in it and drop out the O. But you try to write something in English without the letter E. A romantic novel in which you can't even say the word love, or he, or she. But to return to anagrams and the Baconian hunters of them, I shall not take up more of your time to present some of the more bizarre examples which they wish us to take to our hearts. Most of them are just downright silly, as, for example, the one based upon a well-known title page motto of the 17th century, Labore et Constantia, which they have mangled into, I eat not salter, signed Bacon. Or the one wherein Maester William Shakespeare on the title page of the first volume becomes, I mask as a writer, I spell ham. Or the one from the title page of the New Atlantis, Veritas filia temporis, which becomes, it is true, I am foil spear, and so on. The Baconians verily believe that their examples such as these cannot be matters of pure chance, but they should have by their bedside a copy of this book. And it would give them pause. This is Biblia Anagrammatica, the anagrammatic Bible. It's published by Walter H. Begley, an English clergyman, in 1903. It is an object lesson in patience, but it also demonstrates in dramatic fashion the weakness of the anagrammatic method of proving anything. Begley devotes a whole section of 34 pages to citing only a few of the thousands of anagrammatic verses based upon the angelical salutation, Ave Maria, Gratia Plenum, Dominus Tecum, 31 letters. Writing anagrammatic verses based upon these 31 letters was a popular exercise of pious monks in the 17th century. I'll show you a few examples. Some are in the form of dialogues. Others are short biographies of kings, saints, bishops, or worthies. Some are in Italian. Some are in straightforward poems in Latin or English. One of the most prolific of these anagrammaticists was Blind. One Lucas de Vries alone produced 3,100 specimens. Now, mind you, every line contains those 31 letters, no more, no less. To add to the beauty of the thing, here is an acrostic, an addition. Every line contains those 31 letters, no more, no less, in addition, this acrostic. Tribute to the patience, man. Ingenuity. It's good Latin, too, by the way. Now, believe it or not, the same year that Begley published his Biblia Anagrammatica, he also published anonymously another book, untitled, Is It Shakespeare? Which leaves no doubt of his Baconian sympathies. Among the anagrams collected therein, he quotes one from the last two lines of the epilogue to The Tempest, which reads, oh, well, that's another one of Begley's. Let's go on. So, oh, my goodness. Well, won't they ever stop? Well, this is the dialogue, you see. Every line, 31 letters, dialogue, Satan, serpent. Oh, yes. These are the last two lines in the epilogue to Tempest. And Begley gives the anagram, which he says is remarkable, even though he's not its author, he says. And here it is. Tempest of Francis Bacon, Lord Verulam, do ye ne'er divulge me the words, whatever that means. This sort of performance, we can't call it logic, from a man who has just put together in a good-sized book thousands of anagrams based upon the Ave Maria, should and does confuse and baffle the layman. The professional cryptologist throws in the sponge, or better, what he should do is endeavor to corroborate the identification of Begley as the man who wrote, "Is it Shakespeare?" Remember, I said it was anonymous. I don't know who established the fact that he wrote it. I don't believe it. There are cases in which an author's pen name is a pseudonym made by anagramming the letters of his real name. The most famous one is that of Voltaire. His family name, Arouet, A-R-O-U-E-T, plus the two letters L-J, standing for Le Jeune, the younger. There is, so far as I'm aware, no authentic case in which the writer of a book or play has established his authorship by the anagrammatic method, keyed or unkeyed, within the text of his writings. By acrostics, yes. By anagrams, no. Not in the text. Very rarely on the title page. God's Graves and Scholars, for example, purports to be written by one Serem, C-E-R-A-M. His name is Maritz, M-A-R-E-K. Just the other day, one of the members of this audience received a mathematical paper with the dual authorship. One author was Dr. I.J. Good, a very well-known statistician, British. His collaborator was K. Cage, the letter K, period, C-A-J, and the last name, Doug, D-O-O-G, Jack Good. I don't know whether Jack wanted to have somebody to whom he could point if their errors were found in his book. After making such a categorical statement, it will not astonish you to hear that professional cryptologists can have nothing but a low opinion of the work and the results offered by Pantheistrephordians who use the anagrammatic method to prove their thesis. Among them are such staunch Bacon believers as William Stone Booth, who pinned his faith on what he designated as the well-known string cipher. But Booth fudged an awful lot in his book, Some Acrostic Signatures of Francis Bacon. He mangled the old string cipher beyond recognition. By Booth's scholastic anagrammatics, you can prove any thesis. Now, I am going way over my time. I'm going to catch, almost used a naughty word, from my wife. And I've got to bring this thing to a halt. And we're going to skip. And, well, let's see what this next slide is. This is a slide from Walter Conrad Arnsberg's The Cryptography of Shakespeare. He started out to do a two-volume work on this. He gave up after the first volume. He found Bacon all over the place. But you see what method he used. Anywhere you find a B-A-C-O-N, put them together, rearrange them. Groups, Bacon. Let's try the next slide. Oh, Well, I just used this. Mr. Arnsberg was a delightful man, an accomplished scholar, very well educated, and he devoted his life to this. He lived in Hollywood, by the way, a good many years before he passed away in Hollywood just about 3 years ago. But he came to me one day in Washington, and he said he had absolute proof now that Bacon was the author of Shakespeare, because he took The Tempest, first play in the portfolio, and the first act, first scene, and he got by his anagrammatic method 7 consecutive times. The author was Francis Bacon. I didn't appear startled, and this took him aback a bit. He wanted to know why, and I said, well, you come back tomorrow. I'll see if I have something to show you. This is the first page of Arnsberg's own book, and I took the very first paragraphs, and I did apply his method, and I got the author was William F. Friedman. Did that faze him? No. Said it didn't disprove that his readings in the first folio weren't there. Now, let's see what we come up with next. Oh, well, I'm not going to waste any time on that. Let's get... these are just silly things. See, you take the initial letters, you rearrange them, and you get something. Comedy of errors. They use the message to the reader in the first folio. This is a very famous piece of work. And they anagram it and get very fine messages. I did the same thing, and I got, I and only I, Will Shakespeare, was the author of these old plays. Another reading, Gertrude Stein writ this great work of literature, signed, signed Bob Ripley. The fact is that the English language, or any other alphabetic language, being what it is, there is not much difficulty if you accept the very flexible methods of these Baconian cryptographers in coming up with almost any message your subconscious or subliminal storehouse wants to produce. There are ciphers based upon diagrams, putting the letters in certain places. And I'm going to skip that. I'm going to go... Now, we'll go to the next. Gee, I should have shown you that silly text. Here's a system by a Dr. Cunningham, who passed away in San Francisco not very long ago. His method was to join letters. If you could pass the lines between from one set of letters to another without going through letters you didn't want. See, this is very complicated. So I did. How do we get back to that? I did the same thing, not even using the first folio. I took a high school edition of Julius Caesar, and this is the message I brought out. Dear reader, this is according to Cunningham's method, you see. And then I took another page, and I got from that, I think from the same message, dear reader. Theodore Roosevelt is the true author of this play, but I, Bacon, stole it. Friedman can prove this to you by this cockeyed cipher invented by Dr. Cunningham. There are proofs of Baconian authorship which don't make any sense at all. I mean, the words, for example, This is the solution of the cipher in Shakespeare by a man named Feeley, Martin Feeley, in Rochester, New York. He applies his cipher method without deviation. You see, he hews to the line, let the chips fall where they may, and by George, do they fall. If you can make any sense out of this, this is plain text according to him. This makes sense according to him. People have tried to prove the Baconian authorship by numerology. And sooner or later, this was bound to occur. You see, in the old days, the numbers played a great, great role. For example, if you remember in your Bible study, the number 666 is the number of the beast. If you could add up the numerical values of the letters of the name of some enemy of yours, by George, you have constructed a ballistic missile that'll put a hex on him for right. See? Now, on the other hand, if you had a good friend and you want to pay a tribute, you did something like this. You see, every line in this poem, dedicatory or laudatory, adds to 960. Now, they try by the emblems, too. Here's a page from Peacham's Minerva Britannica, Britannia. Now this is on page 33. This is a very magic number, because if you add up the letters of the name Francis Bacon, they come to 33. Now here is page 33 in this Book of Emblems. There's a hand shaking a spear. Shakespeare. Bacon is proof that something or other. You can carry this sort of proof pretty far. The man who discovered what I show you in the next slide goes to the head of his class. No, not this one. Here's a case where a lady finds Francis Bacon in the initial woodcut letter of the first letter of the first play of the first folio. Francis Bacon, see? But you have to have a darn good imagination to see it. That's the only trouble. Now, what I want to show you here is this gem. Somebody discovered, if you take Psalm 46 and you count down the 46th word from the beginning is the word spear. No, the 46th word from the end is spear, and the 46th word from the beginning is shake. Shakespeare wrote the Bible. Now I'm going to go and call a halt to this thing, because I've gone much beyond my time, but I can't resist one or two more slides. I hope you'll be patient with me. I hope we can get to them fast enough. Let's see. Go on.
That's all.
Boy, am I enciphered. I don't know what happened to those extra slides. Now I know. That's all right. I have just a few words more to say, and this is about the type of writing in which there is apparently no intelligibility and no cipher. I have to modify that in a way, because what I am referring to here is writing of the type of that which is called a modern literature. There you have writing which is apparently in English, but it's meaningless to many people. The devotees of James Joyce don't agree. They say it's all intelligible. You have to work at it. This is true. I will only say, as for myself, about this type of cryptic writing, because that's what it is. Anything which isn't intelligible on its face is cryptic writing, when, no matter whether it's an obvious cipher or hidden. I will repeat what Edmund B. Wilson, the very well-known American literary critic, said of James Joyce, Finnegan's Wake. Today, when we are getting so many books in which the style is perfectly clear, but the meaning non-existent or equivocal, it affords a certain satisfaction to read something that looks like nonsense on the surface, but underneath makes perfect sense. Admirers of Balzac and Trollope think nothing of devoting years to reading their favorites through, and why should we grudge time to Joyce? The demands that he makes are considerable, but the rewards he provides are astounding. It is an exciting, a unique experience. To find pages that have seemed to us meaningless start into vivid life, full of energy, brilliance, and passion. Now, I think that what Wilson says here is a fair criticism and a succinct appraisal of the phenomena involved. The point is, as I've hinted before, that a work of one of the modernists requires a work on our part to decipher or decode before its hidden meaning or real significance becomes clear. Some persons are dubious about the value of such work, both the work of the producer and the product. But let's be fair about this. Just as the mathematician or the devotee of the game of chess or go or of bridge or of any other complex card game engages in what is basically, leaving aside certain psychological factors, a mental activity of a rather high order, and just as these persons derive great satisfaction and pleasure from reaching a solution or playing a good game of chess, so does the cryptologist derive great satisfaction and pleasure from solving a cryptogram, leaving aside also in this case other factors such as the possible effect the solution may have on national defense. So also does the devotee derive satisfaction and pleasure from decoding or deciphering the work of the modernists, or understanding the work of the modern painters or the modern sculptors. In bringing my rather lengthy talk to a close, I may summarize or tie up in one neat bundle about all I've said by closing with these comments. First, we found no valid ciphers in the Shakespeare plays which state that Bacon or anybody else wrote them. Second, it takes work and sometimes hard work to solve a complex problem in mathematics or in cryptography or in modern literature. Third, that the pleasure one derives from reaching a valid solution is often in itself sufficient recompense for the work done. But sometimes the pleasure is accompanied also by a sense of unending satisfaction if the solution turns out to be something of great value or importance in any field of endeavor that makes high achievement in our civilization worthwhile. Thank you very much for your patience and your courtesy in listening so closely to this long and rambling discussion. The exhibits here, there's one exhibit which is really, really very remarkable. A book of over 200 pages in secret writing. Not one word has ever been read by anybody.
And the manuscript, the original of this, just the same as the questions and answers in the quiz program, is kept in the lock box in the vault of the Guaranteed Trust Company in New York. Valued at $100,000. There are only four copies, four static copies. Here is one of them. This is our copy. Not one word in this has ever been read. And it's been known to have been in existence for over 300 years.